Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of Elfonomics with me, Elf Lyons, the comedian and mime, but you will not hear any of that mime today, and my dad, Dr. Jared Lyons. My dad is just doing a mime of tossing a ball over his head, which works perfectly with the subject that we are discussing today, because the subject we are discussing is football. And football and its economic models. And in particular, what can I learn from the economics of football? And the reason we're talking about this is it came into my mind for two reasons. First was I have recently got engaged and I've been retelling my engagement story to my friends in that really joyful way when people go, how did you get engaged? And everyone goes, should I tell it or should you? And then I tell it because I tell it better. Arguably. But I was thinking about your engagement story, Dad. Dad, would you like to tell the listeners of how you proposed to my mother?
Oh, no.
Go on.
We are married 31 and a half years. And Occasionally, my beautiful wife does remind me of how I proposed to her. When she reminds me, it's normally because she's probably not in the best of moods. That's because we haven't been going out that long. We've been going out Two or three months. We did go to Venice for the New Year, which is my wife's birthday. I think she expected me to propose to her in Venice, but that's a bit too predictable. And I didn't. So apparently I subsequently found out she was very confused when we returned. And then luckily for her, Fulham were playing Bolton Wanderers at home. I think it was a League Two game. I went to the game. I had a friend as well. Charlie Stone was there. And halfway through the first half, I said to Charlie, can you go and get some burgers? I don't want a burger. I say, just go and get them. Okay. Fulham were 1-0 down at that time. And I then proposed to Annette on the terraces at Hammersmith End at Craven Cottage. She said yes. We then scored soon after. And it was a 2-2 result. But it was exciting. She said yes. We scored. We avoided defeat, and I proposed to her at Craven Cottage.
And when was that, Dad?
That was January 1990.
Wonderful. And when was your wedding?
September 1990. Fulham, I think, were at home to Gillingham that day, but we didn't go to that game, obviously. and then we lost 2-0. And then you were born the following year. June 1991. You were a honeymoon baby.
I was a honeymoon baby. Yes, I know this very well because you tell me about it frequently. So that made me think about football. Football is something that takes up a lot of my family's weekends and involves lots of people with a ball and people in the audience painting their faces. There is an interval. The first half and the second half tend to be the same length. And I've always found it interesting football because I think artists actually can take a lot from footballers and a lot from how football is managed. But crucially, Dad, as the economics expert, what can I learn from football?
A couple of things, actually. What's amazing is, like, let's take the Premier League is the best league in football, the biggest sport in the world. And what's very evident in the UK, or England in particular, is that the players are really well rewarded. The stars do well. Also, what's key to football success, whether it's in Germany or in England, is that fans are central to the experience. So you need to take them seriously. And this is one of the tensions areas in football at the moment, because fans don't always feel they're as central as they should be. And you basically need to compete. Competition brings the best. Players have to compete against each other in terms of other teams and work well in their own team. So teamwork, but competition really. So the players do well, the artists get the spoils, the fans are critical, and competition is essential.
It's sort of the dream economic model, or an example of healthy economics, in that it's interesting, we never call them the consumer, we call them the fans. The fans have they have huge power to change the game, to influence how the team is managed. For example, with the Super League, you know, that thing where they tried to create like an elite Super League, the fans were so angry they were able to effectively prevent that from occurring. And again, like you said, the artists, the ones who actually do the job, the footballers, they make the money, as opposed to like in the arts, for example, Edinburgh, the Edinburgh Festival, an artist will make the show, will entertain, will do all the hard work and the graft. They don't actually see any of the money at all. It's the opposite in football.
Yeah, you've made a couple of comments there that one at least might need a pushback on, and maybe it might have been the way I explained the importance of the fans. The fans are key to the football success. But here in England, the feeling is that fans are not at the heart of the game, which is why earlier this year, the government introduced legislation to set up a new regulator for football, a regulator that's going to be empowered through legislation. And the feeling is that fans need to start to have more control and more say in their football clubs. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to one of the key issues as to why football has changed. Look, back in the 70s and 80s, football was really in the doldrums in the UK. Football violence, then a whole series of disasters through the 1980s. And at that time, fans were leaving the game, stadiums were being run down. Then suddenly things started to be transformed, partly because football needed to get its act together, but also largely because of money coming in. So stadiums suddenly changed. Some of them lost their character, but stadiums tended to change. New stadiums were built. Attendances started to increase. And also the quality of football also started to improve as England, because of more money, started to become a magnet to skillful and good players from around the world. Mm-hmm. And the fans' experience has improved. But unlike, say, in Germany, where fans effectively have control over the football clubs.
Yeah, the 50-plus method,
50-plus one. It's very interesting. Maybe we'll talk about that later. But here, big money has come in. And while that has worked out for some clubs, in some places it's displaced the fans in the sense that ticket prices are high, far higher than they used to be, and the fans' experience is not always great. Take, for instance, this year. I'm a Fulham fan. I've been to a few of the away games. Away fans, you cap the prices at £30 maximum, or for the FA Cup, it was slightly higher. But you go to the away ground, say, if you're at Leeds, where I went with Fulham, with my son, and to Manchester United even, the away fans were treated, the facilities are terrible. So the fans' experience is not as good as it should be.
Yeah.
So even though, coming back to your point about fans being central, unlike in Germany, the fans maybe are not as central as they should mm-hmm. in the game.
And their loyalty is monetized as well. That's the interesting thing I find about football. Players get paid so much, which I would love to talk to you about further. But before we get on to that, what I find interesting is where the money in football actually goes. Because most fans, the amount of money you spend on tickets can be extreme, like in the hundreds and sometimes even in the thousands, that people will go, the lengths they'll go to see their team play, the lengths to which people will travel to see their team play, the amount of merchandise there is, and, you know, the brand loyalty, wearing the outfit, wearing the uniform, you know, the new changes, the upgrades, you know, the fact that these computer games, FIFA computer games that people buy. But this is all these extras to the game itself, because actually to watch the game, only so many people can go through the turnstiles. Only so many people can buy the tickets. You can't do multiple nights of the same match, unlike with a musician or a theatre show. If it sells out, you add in more. The game is a once event, so, you know, its value is incredibly high. But any fan can just watch it on telly at home. They can stream it. They could watch it later. You can go to a pub and just pay £8 to the barman for a very expensive craft beer and then watch that game and stay there for 2 hours or however long a football game lasts. Two intervals, I'm not sure. Because in my head, it feels like it's an industry that shouldn't actually be making a huge amount of money. And yet, the players are making, well, the elites are, bringing home thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds each week. And crucially, people don't seem to mind so much that footballers make so much money. It's one industry we don't seem to criticise the earnings so much as opposed to other industries.
Yeah, in terms of criticism, the arts generally, you might say, in terms of music and football, people don't seem to be that critical. Whereas someone starts a small business, grows it, they can come in for a lot of stick, even mm-hmm. though they've spent 20, 30, 40, who knows how many years building it. So it's strange that economic rent is the idea. Economic rent is the return you own over and above what you would alternatively be doing. Basically, in football, and you might see it in investment banking in the UK, probably nowhere else, the economic rent goes to the footballer. In fact, the history of football and wages is fascinating. And Fulham, actually, funny enough, played a key part at the beginning. There used to be a maximum wage of £20 okay. in 1961. And Jimmy Hill, who was the head of the players' union, got that abolished. And Johnny Haynes, then Fulham and England captain, was the first £100 a week footballer.
Wow.
But if we move fast forward, when the Premier League started, I think John Barnes was then the top paid player, £10,000 a week. That was 92, 93. And then by the middle of 2005, 2006, Steven Gerrard then at Liverpool became the first £100,000 a week footballer. Now the salaries are astronomical. Paris Saint-Germain or wherever you go, or Gareth Bale, for instance, he was getting over £500,000 a week when he was at Real Madrid. Mm-hmm. So wages have gone through the roof. And it's part of the fact that football has seen an influx of money. England in particular has been the example of that, because we've had influx of money from overseas and broadcasting rights have become key.
That seems to be one of the big changes, because I was thinking about this. People who own clubs don't seem to get huge returns, it seems. They don't seem to get huge financial returns, which is why it seems to be only oligarchs seem to ever own a football club, because they don't really care if they lose a huge amount of money, as it were. The money goes to all the talent. But the way that football seems to be the huge money-making, I don't know what the globule thing it is, it comes from the fact you've got all these TV companies battling to get the rights to show the big games.
And it's part of the fact, well, the global economy has changed. The world economy has opened up. Mm-hmm. So we talk about the world economy. And the English Premier League has been very good in terms of marketing itself to actually gain that premier position or that pole position in terms of global audiences. Back in the 80s, Italian football seemed to be in the ascendancy, then corruption and violence and other things, and it also became less competitive, saw that displaced. So the English Premier League has positioned itself really well. So you get broadcasting rights for domestic and broadcasting rights from the global audience. Mm-hmm. And that has soared.
It's an example of globalisation, isn't it? Because before, in the 60s and 70s, you wouldn't have had an international audience waking up at any time to watch a game that was going on at 2 p.m. on a Saturday.
That's right.
Now everyone can get involved. Everyone can be, regardless of where you are in the country, where you are in the world, you can be a Manchester United fan, you can be a Liverpool fan, and you can feel like you have an actual connection and allegiance to the club because of streaming, because you have the access to watch it.
Yeah, yeah. Back in the day, fans were always seen as being tribal, allegiance to a club. But you're right, the global audience is there. And it's part of Britain's soft power, of the soft power being the influence that you can go across Asia in particular, and to some extent across parts of the States now, and you start to see English football tops being worn by locals all over the place.
So soft power and hard power. Hard power is like when you're super dominant and you use
military power.
So soft power is like me going to someone, hey, can I have a chocolate biscuit? Ooh. And I'm all nice and friendly. Oh, give me a chocolate biscuit. And they're like, oh, she seems really friendly. Of course I'll give her a chocolate biscuit. And hard power, me pulling out a big, big stick and going, give me that chocolate biscuit right now, otherwise I'm going to hit you with a stick. And they're like, whoa, okay, fine, and they give me the chocolate biscuit.
Yes,
that's hard power and soft power, isn't it? That's what I wrote in my A-level.
That's
exam.
Right, yeah. And what you've seen in football, and this is true in many sports, the sort of to the victor goes the spoils. In football, the spoils are phenomenal, which is why you mentioned oligarchs. We now see in the Premier League 8 of the 20 clubs are owned by Americans, so it's affordable, profitable, and the potential is really great. Affordable in the sense they can afford to buy the clubs, their clubs are profitable. In terms of the TV franchise, right, the overseas money mm-hmm. gets split amongst the top 20 clubs in the Premier League. The domestic money, they split half of it equally, but then the rest of it goes to depending where you finish in the league and how many times you're on TV. So this is good for the clubs, but it starts to create challenges. Take the year before the pandemic. I looked at the data on this. The team that finished top in the league, Man City, got £150 million from the TV rights. Mm-hmm. The team that finished bottom of the league in 2019, West Bromwich Albion, still got a huge amount, £97 million. Now, the challenge for them is that if they get relegated, when they get relegated, that revenue stream disappears. So to stop the three clubs that get relegated going out of business, they're given a big parachute payment effectively so that you can land safely as you go down from the Premier League to the Championship, the league below, to help them through the adjustment. But the clubs in the league down, the Championship, find that unfair because they can't compete with these really well-funded clubs. So what one sees in the football is that there's success at the Premier level, but the feeling is that's creating such a big gap now between the Premier and the rest of the leagues, Championship in particular, and also about the need for money almost to filter down to the other leagues and to the grassroots of
would
football.
Would that be called trickle-down economics in this case?
Yes, that's right, where people would actually seem to support it, ironically. But it's about redistribution to keep the fabric of the game going.
The thing that I find interesting, linking back to the parachute payment, what a lovely image, is what we love about football and love about sport is the underdog story, the idea that anyone has the capabilities to win. Someone can come from the bottom and they can get to the top. That is the joy of sport and the fact that it's so equal. It doesn't really matter. On the day, it's the game. It's who scores the most goals. But actually, it's not about that, because when you look at the statistics, time and time again, the team that has the most money, the teams with the highest paid players, are the teams that do the best. So even though it looks like it could be equal, the reality is it's not. Because like you said, if you're a team that doesn't have the money, you are not going to be able to compete.
I think that is correct, and it's borne out by the data. Well, obviously there's the Premier League. There's also the big competition, the FA Cup. But if you go back, say, the last 30 years, I think it's only about four times in the last 30 years that the FA Cup has not been won by one of the big five, mm-hmm. or big six, if you wanted to be generous. Even Everton, who won the FA Cup in the mid-90s, 95, they're no longer one of the big clubs, whereas once upon a time they were. You've had sort of Portsmouth, Wigan, Leicester winning it. But normally it's one of those big five teams that wins it. And those big five dominate the league. Now, the challenge then you get is suddenly you start to see state-sponsored money coming in. Mm-hmm. Manchester City, Newcastle have been bought by a state. And that starts to create this issue is not only corporates and foreign money, the oligarchs, as you called it before, American money now, but state money. And it makes it very difficult to compete.
So when you say state money, do you mean like the government, the local community is giving money?
No, the government of Saudi Arabia.
Right.
And the government of the UAE in terms of the Emirates and Manchester City.
Right.
And Saudi Arabia in Newcastle. So if you look at the... I know you're a big fan of German model.
Well, I wanted to interject here before we get onto the German model. It makes me actually think about the school system in the UK, weirdly, because people go, well, at the end of the day, it just matters. It's about how the kids do in the exam. Everyone's judged equally based on the GCSE and A levels, and it shouldn't matter whether you go to a private school or a state school. You all have the same exam, and if you work hard, the results will tell you. But actually, it's really not that case, as evidenced in football, because actually there's a huge amount of similarities. If you're at a state school, which has very little, limited money and resources, as much training and as much work, you are still going to struggle in comparison to potentially that private school where those teachers are paid much better, there's a higher quality, there's more options to be tutored, to have access to resources, you're treated better, you have more confidence, etc. You are going to do better, and that is always shown in the grades. And actually, when you look at university and entrance, how many students are from private school, how many kids are from state, and that actually seems the same really with football, because the evidence shows if you've got more money being invested in you, you're being paid properly, you've got more support, more attention on you, you do better.
Yeah, money is a key part of it. Of all places, the Bank of England has a note on football. Can I quote from it?
Because
this was February 2019. Only 180 of the 1.5 million players in organised English youth football will make it into Premier League as pros. No reason, obviously, why you expect everyone doing something to become a professional. But I think the point is, and you see this in comments from the English national football team manager, mm-hmm. because of globalisation, it's not just the global market that English clubs are selling into. They're also a magnet for attracting the best international players. And the teams are so international, it's really exciting. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you go back to the 70s or 80s, no harm with it, but in the 70s and 80s, it was primarily from the home countries, England, Scotland, and to a lesser extent from Wales, or Northern Ireland as players who played in the top clubs.
So it becomes incredibly international.
It's very
international. And actually it means that you know, there's an argument against it, though, this idea that we're not spending enough time and focus on grassroots players, because if we have all this unlimited money, why would you spend time training up local players when you could actually go to Brazil or you can go to France or wherever it is and buy the most expensive and brilliant player from there and get them to play for your team if you have the financial ability to.
Obviously, clubs do have good academies, but they don't always keep the players on after the age of 16. The question they have to ask is, will that player make it into the first team? And it becomes very competitive.
So what can they give? Are they viable? Are they actually going to bring us what we need? And if not, no, we cull them.
Yeah. You see, the customer aspect is a very important thing to focus on in terms of the future of the game. What you're seeing at the moment is that the Premier League is starting to sort of really displace, in some respects, other leagues within Europe. In terms of spending power on transfers, I think it was 2001-02 was the last time that the Premier League was outspent by any other league in terms of its spending power. So it can start to buy the best players. And last year, for instance, the Premier League spent about 2.5 billion euros. The next biggest league was the Italian League, which is about 750 million euros, a fraction. But the other leagues can't compete. So the question, here in the UK, we're asking sometimes, because fans think they should be more central, whether we should adopt the German model.
Yeah, ironically, this is the German model. I'm fascinated by this. Yeah. I actually wrote about this in my dissertation for my master's about UK festivals and how I was thinking that festivals should operate under the German football model.
But in Germany, some people are asking whether they should change their model to be like ours.
Can you explain the football model to the listeners, the German football model?
Yeah,
50 German, plus.
Yeah, it's called the 50 plus one rule. So fans have 50% plus one, i.e. are in the majority. So they decide. You can't play if outside investors have a greater say. So the fan is central. And the fan experience in Germany is very good. The good fan culture, low ticket prices, good stadiums, high average attendances. And they attribute that to the way they play. Let me give you an example. Look, Bayern Munich, one of their big clubs, 75% of it is owned by the members club, the fans. The other 25% is split between three corporates. I think it's Adidas, Allianz and Audi. But the model's not always the same. Like Dortmund, for instance, is only 4.6%. So less than 1/20th is owned by the fans. And indeed, Dortmund, 72% of it is on the stock market. So it's not owned by the fans. But what they do there is they have a management company that runs the club. And that's owned or run by the fans. They've had some exceptions. So the point is the fans are not taken for granted.
Yeah.
And if you go on the Bundesliga website, one of the first quotes they have is from the former head of Borussia Dortmund from 2016. And in a nutshell said, if he's no longer regarded as a fan, but instead as a customer, then it's a problem.
Yeah.
Now, in contrast, take the owner of Chelsea, who LA Dodger owner, bought Chelsea last year or the year before. Mm-hmm. The government obviously saw a change in the ownership of Chelsea because Abramovich, the Russian oligarch, was sanctioned because of the war. But the new head of Chelsea gave a talk that got covered last year to private equity. And he never once used the word fan. He only said customer. He never used the word player. He said agent. And he also allegedly said that biggest problem was season ticket holders. Because what he wanted was to get rid of them or scale, phase them out, so you have non-season ticket holders. People have to earn the right by buying merchandise to have access to tickets. And also compared the fact that in England, fans tend to go through their routines. They eat or drink outside the ground. They come to the ground, just watch the football. I think he, like some of the American owners, want to have people being able to have beer in their seats and just spend more at the ground. So it's about really squeezing the last penny out. Now, we might think the German model sounds good, but in Germany, they're under pressure to change it because they need to compete with the Premier League. And also the German national team hasn't done well recently. Now, it's no reason to think that's because of this background, But some people think, oh, that might be because we're not competing enough. So there are exceptions to the 50 plus one rule in Germany, but we can go into them if you want.
It seems sad, though, because it feels like, well, first of all, I always thought Germany had like one of the best teams. They always seem to be doing incredibly well in football competitions that I've heard of in the news. Like,
apart from the last two World Cups.
Okay, last two World Cups. But it seems like a healthier, more ethical model. And it's fascinating and sad for me as a non-football fan, as someone who doesn't know much about the industry. From the outside looking in, it seems sad that model that seems healthy, holistic, and with the fan at the centre is getting shortchanged in order to compete for competition, for economic viability, for financial strength, which seems to be what this gentleman was referring to and seems to be focused on.
Yeah, well, they want to see a return on their money and maximise it. But when you think about American football...
Which isn't football.
Yeah, which is not football. They call it football, but it's not football. They try and make sure that it remains competitive in the sense that, as I understand it, the bottom team gets to choose the best draft or college player, so they equalize it out. Mm-hmm. But then they don't have promotion and relegation, you see. But yeah, the challenge is that with the money, more of the best players go to the best clubs.
So what is the economic model of football? If I was answering a question in an exam paper, what would you say?
Well, people tend to think in the simple terms between capitalist and communist, but it's obviously more capitalist, although there's caveats there. Barriers to entry need to be low, but because money is so key to actually be successful, you need to have someone to come in and sort of be generous and inject money into you as a club. You need to have that competitive element, and that's one of the issues for fans at the moment, that when teams drop out of the Premier League into the Championship with that parachute payment, that's to protect them, but it makes it difficult for other clubs to compete. So the gulf is vast. That's why it's important and imperative to have that money. There's some redistribution across the football pyramid, as it's called. And also to maybe have less football.
Never thought you'd say that.
In the sense you can have too many competitions and that starts to dilute the quality of it. Of course, it's up to the players themselves. Players might always think they're going to go to the big club and play for the big team in the first team, but their squads are so big. So clubs in the mid-tier need to keep their good players.
Okay. It's interesting because it's a mixture of you've got the money from the fans or the consumer, you get money from the state, you get money from independent oligarchs, philanthropy, investment, and then you get the money from Sky, from the TV. There's so many different revenues or income streams here, if that's the right turn of phrase.
But football is going through a transformation. This idea of football regulator... Often regulation can seem very intrusive, but it's not about too much or too little regulation. It's about having good regulation. And what the government has tried to do is, by introducing this idea of a regulator, is to sort of go along with what the fans want. We've already seen safe standing areas introduced. It's about more money to the grassroots. Also, an independent review of women's football. Women's football is starting to prosper. And then it's about sort of triggering change that improves the fans' experience. Mm-hmm. But of course, it goes against this idea of customers versus fans.
This is it. These are my final 2 points, and then we'll sort of wrap it up. Because obviously, I want to ask you, what can I as an artist learn from football? What can I take away? But relating back to that point, I find it really interesting is how many people constantly get sacked in football. It seems to be there's very little forgiveness or loyalty or understanding, it seems, from a manager's perspective. I'm always surprised at how many times when I'm walking through a station and I'll look up at the Sky news board and it's like so-and-so sacked after one season. You know, these managers seem to be churned and just treated very, like, very quick flash in a pan commodities. Is that right or am I totally wrong?
You're right. Some clubs are more loyal to their managers than others. At one extreme, you have Watford and Nottingham Forest, who became notorious in the last decade for changing managers. But even in the Premier League, any team at the bottom suddenly thinks, first thing, let's change the manager, sometimes twice in the season. And it doesn't guarantee success. Obviously, a manager can have an impact, but is short-termism might be the way of thinking about it. But the other is this fear of a cliff edge if you're relegated to the league below you. The Championship is probably even worse than the Premier League, or it is, in terms of churning and turnover. Managers play an important role, and therefore, ideally, you want stability. In the wider corporate world, you tend not to have managers changed as much. But then in the wider corporate world, there's succession planning. Rarely does that happen in football. If a manager goes, his number two, three, four tend to go with him. So football structure is very different to the non-football business world. Mm-hmm. And the relationship between the fans and the management, as opposed to customers and the management in other companies, is very different.
Yeah. So to wrap up, Dad, what I find interesting, and this is something you've always said to me, is like, if I can find 100 people or 1,000 people who really love the work that I do, and I can get them to keep coming back to my work during the year, I will be able to have a good, sustainable business as an artist. And it's one thing that I'm very lucky to have, in that I have loyal supporters of my art who don't just see my show once, they come and see it twice, or they indeed travel to come and see my shows throughout the year. And it makes me think about football in the same that you have fans who will come and see the football, the game played time and time again, regardless of the good, the bad, the ugly. So alongside that, what can I as an artist learn from football?
Yeah, great question. Maybe the first thing to do is step back and to have an understanding of how the industry itself has changed, what's driven those changes, and what have been the consequences. And then you can take out the sort of real nuggets that will add value. So understanding the changes in football in the last few decades.
One thing that I find really interesting about you, and especially about you and Mum, and about why I think you are epically cool parents, is when I wanted to be an artist and wanted to be a comedian, you were always so supportive. But in particular, when I would say to you, oh, I think I should retrain, I think I should do this on the side, I'm going to do this as well and do this, because I was constantly looking at different revenue streams and different ways to make a living, you would always say this, you'd always give me this example. David Beckham wanted to be a football player, and David Beckham practiced every day, kicking balls for hours. And he'd practice with his right leg and with his left leg. He didn't waste time trying to do other things. He focused on the thing he wanted to do and what he wanted to be good at, and which is why he's not just a good footballer, but one of the best footballers in the world. And so you'd always remind me to be like David Beckham. How much I have achieved that is arguably uncertain. But I always think, what would David Beckham do? And I've always tried to persevere with being the best artist and comedian theatre maker that I am.
The David Beckham experience. Keep investing hard work in yourself. Obviously, you've got the skill as a talent. Although the difference, obviously, between football and comedy is that naturally, even great footballers have to retire. Comedians aren't constrained by that physical challenge. Mm-hmm. Your life expectancy at the top of your game might be higher in your field than it is even for the best footballers.
Yeah.
Obviously, they need to keep themselves in shape, as must you. But investing in yourself, keep training. The fact that these footballers, even at the top of their game, are still investing in themselves, looking after themselves, that's a great thing. Second, you need to find the right home to where you practice your skills. It's the club and the league, obviously, when it comes to football. But you need to be going to the good venues. You need to be thinking about where you market your skills. The third is the medium. English football really took off, not just when more money came in, but when that new money was associated with maximising its marketplace, global as well as domestic. And TV played a big part in that. Obviously, you've done a lot of TV and radio, but the medium, how you market yourself. And the Super League experience was fascinating. What never really got mentioned at the time was that the clubs themselves, the English clubs who wrongly, in my view and other view, wanted to go into that Super League, wanted to almost cut out the middle person. They wanted to market themselves direct to their fan base. There wasn't Sky or BBC associated with them. They didn't have a media partner. So that medium in terms of how you communicate or market your skills is vital. That's the third area. And the fourth is the fans themselves. Look, I would support Fulham, whatever league they were in. It's easy to get to when they're not in the Premier League. But obviously, the fans want to see their club compete, not lose. It's no fun being in the higher division and losing all the time. But fans can be loyal. So that bond between the club and the fans, and sometimes between the players and the fans, is something to value as well as to make the most of. So fans have to be key at the heart of the experience for football to prosper. And therefore, the same should be the case in comedy as well.
Cool. Thanks, Dad. I love you. Say it back.
I love you too.
Okay, good. And that was our episode of Elfonomics with me, Elf Lyons, and my happy dad, Dr. Jared Lyons. Bye.
Bye.